Chapter 32. The Lusitania Affair. For 1 year the American people had been led to believe what their government was saying, never knowing what it was scheming. As early as February 1915 the British were quite sure they could get away with anything, so much so they had not hesitated in using the American flag on their own vessels. One could well imagine the international outcry if German ships had done the same thing. Washington, wrote Professor Seymour, House, 1, 404, advised Great Britain as to the dangers of flying American flags on her ships without any authorization. This maritime fraud was, of course, known to the Germans. Strangely, House's humbling experience in England did not prevent him from returning as a discreet and reliable British ally. The American electorate had still to be handled with care. The 1916 elections had to be won because a defeat could threaten the administration's war plans. President Wilson organized days of prayers for peace. That suited everybody, especially those who envisioned spending the war reaping profits from it. There was, however, a danger that the banks involved in financing the various belligerents would be damaged in the conflict. The lending institutions would be hard put not to take sides when it came to protecting their investments. A defeated side could well drag leaders down with it. The Allies' large fleet qualified them as preferred borrowers. There were large quantities of cotton and munitions to be sold and shipped. The American public was sold the notion that such loans would be good for business and prosperity. Wilson helped the loan program when he informed the banks, "The government sees no objection in opening banking credits to all belligerents." In theory it sounded impartial, but in reality the Allies would receive 95% of the loans and Germany 5%. Professor Pierre Renouvin, a staunch supporter of the Allies, had to admit, American economic and financial relations were almost exclusively tied to Great Britain and France. How could such a situation not have political consequences? The neutrality of the United States is no longer impartial. At the beginning this imbalance was not an issue. House maintained, "We will act not only to save civilization but also for our own benefit." To the banks, the Allies were attractive clients. They paid well and on time with money borrowed from the United States government. The Germans had not reacted violently to this situation. They were finding alternatives. Cut off from the sea, they supplied themselves by land. They increased their purchases from Norway by 80%, from Denmark and Sweden by 200%. They would even buy English tea in Sweden. The British have always had a very flexible conscience when it came to looking after their own interests. They would attack neutral vessels carrying goods to Germany and at the same time sell their surpluses even if they knew the Germans would eventually use them. Professor Renouvin explained this mercantile practice. In order to reduce trade deficits, Great Britain thought it wise to re-export their surpluses even if the enemy would eventually profit by that. As the Entente's banker, the British government ranked financial considerations above all else. Thus the British were fencing to the Germans what they had piratically rifled from neutral ships, and neutral ships were sunk with increasing frequency by the British Navy. Reaction against British piracy was offset by the German sinking of the Lusitania on May 7, 1915, off the southern coast of Ireland. The tragedy was used as a propaganda bonanza by the British lobby in the United States. The liner was British, not American, but 118 of her passengers were United States citizens. "We will be at war with Germany within a month," declared House. Page, the pro-British United States ambassador in London, was elated, and cynically hoped for another such sinking. On July 21, 1915 he cabled House, "It is strange to say, but I only see one solution to the present situation, a new outrage at the Lusitania sinking that would force us into war." On January 11, 1916 House cabled Wilson with similar cynicism, "England should be grateful for all acts of terrorism committed by Germany because each person, man, woman or child killed on land or sea, is dying for England." Facts mattered little, everything was used for the propaganda mills. In 1914, the British story that Germans were cutting off children's hands had done wonders on the propaganda front, and so had the British version of the Lusitania sinking. House cabled Wilson again to tell him how happy he was that the German Zeppelins had bombed London and killed 200 people. He quoted the remark of British minister on the matter, "It's a pity they did not shake up the west of England, where recruitment has been lagging." The Lusitania gave the American press a field day. There was an explosion of journalistic outrage about the murder of innocent tourists. The massive press exploitation of these unfortunate passengers was decisive. It did not drag America into the war within a month as House had predicted, but it nearly did away with America's neutrality. The Lusitania victims were combined with the stories of German gun emplacements in Brooklyn, the cutting off of Belgian children's hands, and other barbarities. The Germans had now become Teutons and Huns. It took half a century to establish the truth about the Lusitania. An underwater exploration of the sunken ship revealed that its hulls were full of ammunition. The British arms dealers had used tourists to camouflage their war material. They had used 1,200 lives to hide their contraband and collect their ill-gotten gains. The Germans were aware of this deception and were well within the bounds of international law by attacking an arms-carrying enemy vessel. The Lusitania was a warship disguised as an ocean liner by the British arms merchants. They lured 1,200 innocent people to their deaths, and they alone bear the guilt of this tragedy. As they unconscionably flew American flags on British ships to cover up their trafficking, so did they use innocent people. The truth about the Lusitania came half a century late. It was historically important, but was of no relevance to the events of World War I. The case illustrates well that truth at the time is better than the truth later. The Germans were overwhelmed by the superior British propaganda machine. The sheer weight of its pervasive influence could turn lies into facts throughout the world. Germany was never able to put its side of the story across for lack of a propaganda network, and was forced to go along with British fraud. It indemnified families of American citizens lost in action and undertook not to attack passenger-carrying vessels, without due warning and not before, the lives of noncombatants had been insured protection. Such a declaration made all German submarines vulnerable. How could submarines inspect armed vessels like the Lusitania without being shot at as soon as they surfaced? They would be blown apart in short order. Furthermore, the Lusitania incident supplied the excuse to place guns on American merchant vessels. Thus, for a year and a half, the entire German submarine fleet would be restricted to its bases in Germany while the Allies plied the seas as they wished. This one-sided imposition on the German government was deemed intolerable even by members of the Wilson administration. On October 2, 1915, the Secretary of State told House, "If our merchant ships are armed, they will have every advantage over enemy submarines expected not to fire without warning. The British cannot have their cake and eat it too. It is unfair to force a submarine to warn a ship likely to use the warning time to sink it." Even the most pro-British member of the Wilson administration, Ambassador Page, remarked on February 1, 1916. "Submarines are a recognized weapon of war as far as the British are concerned, as they are also using them. It seems absurd to me to expect a submarine to surface and be responsible for the security of the passengers and crew and at the same time make itself a target. Merchant vessels not only shoot submarines on sight but are certainly ordered to do so." British Minister Arthur Balfour confirmed this view: "If the captain of a merchant ship discovered a submarine across the bow, it is my opinion very likely that he would endeavor to ram it. I frankly admit that if I were in command of that ship, I would act likewise." House, 2, 240. Meanwhile, House was attempting a last maneuver. On February 18, 1916, he sent to the Allied ambassadors an unofficial note proposing to disarm all merchant ships. In return, they would no longer be attacked without warning or torpedoed unless they resisted or attempted to escape. The Allies did not hide their displeasure. How could the British not be displeased by attempts to thwart their piracy? British provocation on the seas was one way to bring the United States into the war sooner or later. For the plan to succeed, it was necessary that German submarines sink as many American vessels as possible. It was the only way to turn American public opinion in favor of war. From then on, the top priority British objective was to drive German submarines to sink American ships. The American public would put up with two or three more sinkings. After that, it was easy for the press to stampede people. Submarine warfare was the Allies' trump card, guaranteed to bring America into the war. The Allies had found the battlefields quite punishing and were looking forward to the arrival of millions of American soldiers and billions of American dollars. Any maritime agreement had to be strenuously opposed. The blockade would force the Germans into naval warfare involving American vessels, which in turn would force America to join and win the war for the Allies. Although House went along, others had reservations. Secretary of State Lansing objected to being made an unwilling accomplice in a flagrant violation of international law. On February 3, 1916, he stated, "Since all merchant ships coming to America have been armed with guns, I believe we are really asking too much of Germany." For the preceding 20 months, Germany had acquiesced to the point of being virtually at the mercy of the Allies on every sea lane. But the British government needed blood, not conciliation. Provocations were multiplied. Germany was left to choose between defeat or self-defense. Either way would play into British hands. On February 29, 1916, Germany was forced to declare that from now on, armed merchant vessels would be considered as auxiliary cruisers and treated as such. It was now easy for Wilson to demand with indignation that Germany guarantee the life of American passengers on British vessels. He did not suggest how the Germans could possibly distinguish Americans from other passengers. Most Americans did not realize a war was on. Professor Seymour wrote, "The onus is on the travel lovers to avoid using belligerent vessels, and their presence on board is likely to lead to international incidents. By refraining from crossing the combat zone, Americans would no longer imperil themselves." The Germans had set aside specific combat zones which had been recognized by the United States. Congress did not want a military confrontation with Germany. It adopted the German definition. House, 2, 244. This wise decision exasperated Wilson. He opposed Congress on the issue, "I cannot consent to any restrictions concerning the rights of American citizens." House, 2, 245. The statement was irrational. Restrictions as to war zones did protect people from getting killed. Such restrictions are in effect daily, as in people being detoured from the paths of an avalanche or the scene of a fire. It was not necessary for Americans to board armed vessels to go to Europe. There were many alternatives. Wilson's grandstanding on American rights was obviously linked with British provocation. House was concerned that the president had overplayed his hand. "The president and Lansing have, I believe, put themselves into a mess. All the polls indicated that 90% of Americans were still opposed to any military intervention in the European war." Within a year, a handful of provocateurs would use the submarine issue to bring America to the edge of disaster. Unfortunately, the American people did not know they were being hoodwinked. The 2,000 pages of notes left by House belatedly reveal the frantic activities of the pro-war lobby. All the notes involve the year 1915. "My opinion has not changed, the conflict is inevitable. We must act decisively. I think to send more communications to Germany would be a mistake. House. Our hopes, our aspirations, our sympathy are closely bound to those of the democracies." Page, U.S. Ambassador, in London. Another 1915 document reports a conversation between Wilson and Brand Whitlock, an American diplomat based in Brussels. "Brand Whitlock, I do not accept our state of neutrality. I am on the side of the Allies with all my soul and mind." Wilson, loudly, "And so am I." However, Wilson would keep his feelings from being made public until after the next year's elections. Playing to the electorate, he would, instead, say sanctimoniously, I have no right to force the American people to participate in a war they do not understand. House, 2, 263. House was back from London. His complicity with British Foreign Minister Grey was such that they had devised a secret code for their correspondence. Scores of letters and cables would bypass government channels, establishing a private line of communication between the foreign minister of a belligerent state and the president's advisor of a neutral one. One of these secret messages to Grey shows how at odds House was with real public opinion in the United States. The nation continues to show itself clearly opposed to war, and I seriously doubt that Congress would support the president if he decides otherwise. July 8, 1915, House, 2, 70. Yale professor Charles Seymour describes what the American people felt during these months of intrigue. The blockade that the British had tightened at the beginning of summer had raised a storm of complaints from the American shippers. They loudly denounced Wilson and the State Department for abjectly accommodating the British while neglecting American interests. They demanded reprisals against the British. House, 282. House conceded that the American public was not buying pro-war arguments. Our quarrel with Germany does not stir much emotion in the west of the country or to the south of Ohio. That's three-fourths of the country. House, 260. He added, as for the rest of the country, I noticed that it is the old men and sometimes women who are displaying bellicosity. United States senators also expressed their will not to tolerate British maritime blackmail. The Senate demands that ever stronger pressure be put on England and its allies so that they can renounce their restrictions affecting neutral trade. Yet on August 4, 1915, House was writing to Ambassador Page and describing his sadness that 90% of our nationals are opposing our going to war. House, 274. Allied propaganda directed at the American public was often favorably received, even though the stories were getting taller. For instance, the United States ambassador in Berlin cabled, "The Kaiser is losing his mind, he spends his time praying and studying Hebrew." House, 2, 124. A note from Wilson himself informs us, "Northcliffe assured us last night that the Kaiser is dying of throat cancer." Stories about bloodthirsty Huns resurfaced in the news. On August 26, 1915, House warned, "German agents will no doubt try to blow up hydroelectric plants, gas and electricity stations, subways and bridges in cities like New York." House urged Wilson to exploit the Lusitania sinking to the point at which the rupture with Germany became inevitable and the United States would be forced to enter the war on the side of the Allies. House, 296. Secretly, he would submit to Grey a Machiavellian peace plan to be presented to the German government. The conditions were to be made unacceptable to ensure they would be rejected by the Kaiser. The rejection would then enable the United States to join the Allies in order to save the peace. It goes without saying, House explained to the British minister, that I will not let the Germans know we are in agreement with the Allies, but I will attempt on the contrary to convince them they, the Allies, will reject our proposals. This could influence them in accepting them. If they did not, their refusal would be enough to justify our intervention. House, 2, 107. The message was as tortuous as the Talmud. Even Wilson thought the offer was too blatantly in favor of the Allies. When House conveyed to Grey that if the Central Powers still rejected our proposals we would be obliged to join the Allies, Wilson inserted the word probably between would and be obliged. It looked more diplomatic. House shamelessly flattered Wilson to get his way. Whenever the president acted on House's advice, House would write, "Never indeed has a more noble role fallen to a son of man." House, 2, 108. Wilson's susceptibility to such outrageous flattery was no small factor in his decision-making. It is a fact that Wilson hated Germans. Many documents attest to it. Other people dislike Americans, Arabs, blacks or crime of crimes Jews. Wilson disliked Germans. That was no doubt his right, but it also made him particularly unsuitable to act as a referee. Despite his aversion to them, Wilson did not mean deliberately to push the Germans into ruin. He did it because House, the brain of the operation, maneuvered him into the European War in 1917. The American diplomat William Bullitt wrote with some honesty, House was Wilson's alter ego, and he had decided to drag the American people into a war under the pretext of a humanitarian gesture, to help the Allies realize their aims. Wilson's erratic behavior between October 1915 and May 1916 can be attributed to House's deceitful actions. He always talked peace while actively promoting war. Wilson never saw through House because he was an average politician with a mediocre vision of the world. He regarded House's international meddling with admiration because it was all quite beyond him. House was always careful to make the president believe he, Wilson, had all the ideas. Sometimes, however, House overplayed his hand. Wilson was very uneasy with Britain's violations of international law and attacks on neutral ships and really felt he had the duty to impose sanctions. It took all of House's flattering talent to coax the president back on the British path. All this anguished Wilson, because basically he would have rather had peace, he saw himself as a friend of mankind. Unfortunately, his mind was vapid, his will was weak. He did not rush into war, he was pushed into it. A domestic event also increased Wilson's inaction. A widower, he had suddenly fallen in love with a certain Edith Ballingault. The courtship absorbed him so much that he let House virtually do all his thinking. Says House himself, he was madly in love, with the zeal of a 60-year-old who suddenly felt old. The president was no longer reading his correspondence, including Gray's communications. On December 18, 1915, the ailing president married Mrs. Galt. She would be, from now on, the only interest in Wilson's life and leave her own mark on the presidency, particularly after the war. Apart from marital bliss, Wilson was preoccupied with prophecy. He had vague notions of rallying all the world's people to a higher ethic. The Allies laughed at Wilson behind his back. They listened to his visions, but only for the purpose of emptying America of its dollars when the time came. Wilson had the key to the cash box, so they endured his preaching. House was determined to trap the Germans. He brought substantial support to the Allies and the ultimatums he engineered after the sinking of the Lusitania and the Arabic intimidated the Germans on the seas for months. The Allies greatly benefited, but showed little gratitude. Gray explained that whatever concessions Wilson extracted from the Germans, none were of any concern to the Entente. The British government never shared Wilson's quest for peace. For Lloyd George, the war had become an excellent business, and he was in no hurry to settle it. House described the British Prime Minister's satisfaction, because of the fact that people will have acquired better habits and young people will have been subjected to serious training, one will live longer. Productivity will be increased because the lazy will be forced to work and keep on working. The added workforce will add more than $1 billion to the wealth of Great Britain. Further, people will lead a far simpler life and that should save millions of dollars. House, 2, 147. House added that Lloyd George had concluded his remarks, "War can go on indefinitely." Gray had so little interest in Wilson's peace plan that he saw fit not to talk about it to his allies. Professor Seymour remarked that Gray was so convinced the Allies would reject the plan that he did not even discuss the possibility of accepting it. Gray made clear that the Allies would be suspicious of any conference. On November 25, 1915, House wrote, "The offer I brought with me, and which was to secure the victory of the Allies, deserved, it seems to me, to be more warmly received." House, 2, 145. The offer was thrown into the trash can. From Boulogne in France, House sent Wilson the last British offer. "It is understood that if the Allies make any significant progress during spring or summer, you should not intervene, but should the war turn to their disadvantage or become static, then you would come in." Lloyd George proposal to Wilson, House, 2, 187. The British perceived American intervention as a stopgap in case of defeat, as did the French. House had promised the Allies he would not breathe a word to anyone about the offer. He warned Wilson it was strictly private between himself and the Allied leaders. "I have given my word that I would not talk about it to anyone in America, with the exception of Lansing and yourself." Thus, for the duration of the First World War, the American people had no inkling of the international shenanigans being acted out in their name, but against what they desired. Wilson was well aware of the people's strong neutrality. "I do not believe that the Americans want to get into the war, whatever number of our countrymen get torpedoed." Bullitt, President Wilson, 282. Three men with the power to make war imposed their secret diplomacy on 100 million Americans kept in complete ignorance.